From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A report from Indonesia as thousands protest and the dictator Suharto is once again affirmed by his largely hand-picked assembly. Students against sweatshops organize around this country to demand a code of conduct from Nike, Reebok, and other corporations signing contracts with their universities. And in a surprise move, the British government announces it will not extradite Irish activist Roisin McCloskey to Germany. We'll speak with Roisin's sister, Deirdre. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. General Suharto was selected president of Indonesia today by a hand-picked assembly in a process that has taken place every 5 years since the dictator took power in a coup in 1965, resulting in the slaughter of 500,000 Indonesians. Thousands of protesters demonstrated in 4 cities today for democratic reform. Police attacked protesters, 10 of whom were arrested for attending a banned political rally in Jakarta, the capital. This news from Chile, full military ceremonies are scheduled today in Santiago for the retirement of Commander-in-Chief and former dictator Augusto Pinochet. At the same time, demonstrations by people and organizations that bore the brunt of his repressive 17-year rule are expected to peak against his plan to accept a permanent seat in Chile's Senate. Protesters plan to form a human chain around the building to prevent him from entering. Pinochet's critics say a man who shut down Congress and persecuted lawmakers after taking power in a bloody military coup has no place in the legislature. The Pinochet regime was accused of massive human rights abuses, including thousands of political killings. Some lawmakers are planning to begin proceedings to impeach Pinochet the minute he sits in Congress, but their effort appears sure to fail because the right-wing opposition holds a majority in the Senate. This news from Nigeria. One of the country's best-known literary figures, Nobel laureate Wole Soyinka, said yesterday a new coalition of exiles is pushing to restore democracy in the West African nation. Soyinka, who is living in exile in the United States, said in a statement several groups of Nigerians have joined overseas to campaign against the country's military ruler, General Sani Abacha. Soyinka, a prominent poet and playwright who won the 1986 Nobel Literature Prize, heads the African American Studies program at Emory University in Atlanta. He's wanted by the Nigerian military regime for treason and could face the death penalty if he returns home. The activists welcome Pope John Paul II's visit to Nigeria on March 21st. They urge the pontiff to, quote, identify with the cause of the Nigerian people for freedom, genuine democracy, and immediate termination of military power. Since coming to power in a 1993 coup, Abacha has faced sharp criticism for jailing hundreds of dissidents, a number of whom have died in jail. This news from Harare. Zimbabwean paramilitary police officers clubbed hundreds of students in the central capital today to break up a demonstration backing demands for higher student aid grants. Witnesses said about 100 police officers armed with shotguns, shields, and riot sticks charged into a crowd of about 400 students outside the Ministry of Higher Education, beating and dispersing them. Some students were injured. The police also sealed and deployed heavily armed units at 3 Harare colleges. Serbian police returned for burial 51 bodies of ethnic Albanians killed in a sweep of what they said were rebel strongholds in central Kosovo province. Serbian officials contend the women and children who died were killed by armed rebels who refused to let them surrender. But there was mounting evidence that the Serb police had killed unarmed civilians and executed males whom they detained. Meanwhile, the United States and a group of allies imposed diplomatic and economic sanctions on Yugoslavia because of President Slobodan Milosevic's use of force against the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. And a former Bosnian Serb paramilitary commander pleaded guilty to rape as a war crime before an international tribunal in The Hague. Dragoljub Karnarac, who turned himself into French NATO peacekeeping troops last week, admitted he'd raped Muslim women during the Bosnian War in 1992. Human rights groups have estimated more than 30,000 women were sexually abused in the Balkan fighting. The CIA and other intelligence agencies would be barred from punishing whistleblowers who supply Congress with classified information under a bill approved 93-1 yesterday by the Senate. The measure would direct the president to inform employees of the CIA, FBI, and other intelligence agencies that reporting alleged wrongdoing to Congress is not prohibited by law, executive order, or regulation, even if classified information is involved. A similar requirement was passed by the Senate last year, but removed after President Clinton threatened a veto. And finally, in a surprise decision, Britain has ordered ailing Irish activist Roisin McCloskey freed rather than extradited to Germany. We'll have more on that story later in the show. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of students have hit the streets throughout Indonesia, the world's fourth largest country, in recent weeks to demand the ouster of dictator General Suharto, whose more than 30-year regime looks increasingly shaky. This even as he has been once again selected by a largely hand-picked assembly to be president of Indonesia today. The protests come in the wake of a major devaluation of the country's currency and a crippling banking crisis where companies have been unable to pay back loans. The IMF has arranged an $18 billion bailout package, but in return has demanded stiff austerity measures like a rise in food prices. Activists in this country, as well as Indonesia, have demanded that the United States not support this IMF $18 billion bailout. We're joined on the phone right now from Jakarta, Indonesia, the capital of Indonesia, by two people who can tell us what's happening on the ground there. We're joined by Matthew Jardine, who has long been investigating the situation in Indonesia and in occupied East Timor. His most recent book, co-authored with Constancio Pinto, is called East Timor's Unfinished Struggle Inside the Timorese Resistance. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matthew.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you.
Well, can you tell us what has happened today and in recent days in Indonesia?
Well, today, for example, there was an attempt to have a pro-democracy congress in the city of Jakarta. It was a very small gathering, about 50 or 60 activists. It was to be held in a hotel, in a private room in the hotel. And as soon as it began, the Indonesian police entered the room and tried to arrest the main speaker. Some of the pro-democracy activists tried to prevent the police from arresting her by surrounding her to protect her. And it ended up many of the activists were kicked and beaten by the police. Nine of them ended up arrested. And this is part of a larger crackdown that we've seen over the last couple of months here in Indonesia. According to pro-democracy and human rights activists, well over 1,000 individuals have been detained over the last couple of months, and there have been at least 9 murders, and there are 14 people missing or disappeared. So this is the political climate that's taking place right now in Indonesia.
You know, it's interesting to see how the press plays the reappointment of the dictator Suharto to another term today. The front page of the Christian Science Monitor says indispensability may save Indonesia chief. And on the inside, the article on the inside on Indonesia quotes a World Bank official who says, until the last 6 months, few could say there were any better decision makers in the world. Can you talk about Suharto and his selection as president? What exactly does that mean?
Well, on the one hand, to the people of Indonesia, it doesn't really mean that much in that it's not significant in that it represents any sort of change. It represents only an intensification of a downward spiral economically and continuing political unrest. It's very interesting to be watching the TV and to be reading the press here in Indonesia, because they're covering intensively this meeting of the People's Consultative Assembly that just re-elected Suharto. And, of course, the whole thing is stage managed, the whole thing is orchestrated, but it's, at least by the media here, which are tightly controlled and tightly circumscribed in terms of what they can do, it's presented as something that's really serious. To the average person here in Jakarta, or throughout Indonesia, everyone knows that this is what it appears to be, and that is a meaningless charade. But it's interesting, I can't read the Christian Science Monitor here, but it's interesting how they present him. And of course, that's the view of the White House, that and the West in general, that Suharto has long been sort of their kind of guy, as one White House official said a couple of years ago when Suharto visited Washington, D.C. Long been an important decision maker, long been an important strongman in maintaining control over this country, which, of course, is in the interests of international capital. Indonesia is, of course, the world's fourth largest, in terms of population, the fourth most populous country. It's an important center for multinational corporate activity. It's extremely resource-rich, and the U.S. and the West in general want to make sure that this lucrative relationship that's been established over the last 30 years of the Suharto regime stays in place. So the re-election, if we can call it that, of Suharto this week represents an effort on the part of the regime and the West to maintain this very lucrative status quo, but it's a status quo that's on extremely shaky ground. As in your intro, you mentioned that thousands of university students have been demonstrating throughout Indonesia on a daily basis, and while on one hand things seem pretty stable here in Jakarta, you know, if you scratch the surface, it quickly becomes evident that there's widespread discontent, and it would seem that the economic and political crisis can only intensify. In that sense, Suharto's re-election is a temporary victory, at best, for the forces of the status quo.
You know, it's quite something to see Indonesia day after day, the front page headlines of newspapers in this country, when for so long it has gotten almost no attention. And you have the latest situation in Iraq, where the press talks about Saddam Hussein as a vicious dictator. And yet you have Suharto, the longest reigning dictator in the world today, who has killed, it's estimated, close to 1 million people of his own people and those in occupied Timor.
That's right. I just came from East Timor, actually, a couple of days ago. And it is amazing when you think about, look at the U.S. press. They present the crisis in Indonesia and they don't talk about East Timor these days, but they present the crisis in Indonesia as purely, for the most part, economic in nature. And they totally ignore the very deep political roots and manifestations of this crisis, and especially the many political crimes of Suharto. Within Indonesia and East Timor, the situation, as you can imagine, for the mass of people is extremely difficult. The Indonesian rupiah, the currency, has declined by about 75% since July. In Indonesia proper, over 10 million people have lost their jobs, and the prices of the basic foodstuffs like oil and rice and bathing soap and things of that sort have skyrocketed. So it's creating great, great economic hardship. And, of course, the political repression in Indonesia and Indonesia proper has increased. And within Indonesian-occupied East Timor, the repression is as bad as ever.
Gosh, I would think it's great for corporations like Nike. With the money devalued, they're paying their workers now almost nothing in terms of the exchange rate. But I wanted to ask you about this IMF bailout that people in this country have been organizing against, the $18 billion IMF bailout that the U.S. is supporting, that Clinton is trying to push through. On the one hand, you had liberal Democrats. We had Barney Frank on Democracy Now! A little while ago, the congressmember from Massachusetts, who was decrying this bailout, saying it was a total outrage. That there had to be human rights stipulations around it because this is support for a dictator. But now it seems that the Democrats are dying down in their criticism because President Clinton has thrown them a bone, and that is saying he will press for an increase in the minimum wage in this country. And so now it's the right-wing Republicans who are opposing this IMF bailout. Can you talk about the activism around this?
In the United States or in Indonesia?
In the United States.
Right. Well, you know, not being there for the last couple of weeks, I'm not sure what's been going on, but I can say that activism vis-a-vis the IMF is very important in terms of pressuring the administration to conduct itself in a way that is supportive of the pro-democracy and human rights movements here in Indonesia and in East Timor. The IMF, the U.S. portion of the IMF bailout, as you mentioned, is $18 billion. That's one portion of a $43 billion total package in the IMF. In some ways, though, I think the focus on the IMF is somewhat misplaced, in that what the, in the U.S. press, again, it's very interesting to see how they report on this. They present it as a struggle between sort of the forces of democracy and economic transparency, as represented by the United States and the IMF, who are battling against this corrupt, authoritarian dictator Suharto, right? So this is the struggle as presented in the press, whereas really the struggle is one between what we might call, we might consider it a lover's quarrel of sorts, right? A quarrel between Suharto and his longtime backer, the United States. That's not to say that, activism around the IMF is not important, but it's important to place this IMF issue in the larger context of a very lucrative and criminal relationship between the United States and Suharto that has taken place over the last 30 years. I'm not sure at this point that there's much we can do in the United States to actually stop the IMF bailout, and which is basically a lifeline for the Suharto regime. But what we can do is try to fight for conditions that would be attached to the U.S. portion of the support, conditions having to do with human rights, labor rights, conditions having to do with support for self-determination in East Timor, conditions attached to trying to lessen the role of the military in Indonesian society.
Matthew Giardina, I'm just interrupting because we only have a few minutes, and I know that sitting at your side is Sidawati, who is a pro-democracy campaigner in Indonesia, and we'd like to speak with her. Matthew Giardina, by the way, is not his real name. He is co-author with Constancio Pinto of East Timor's Unfinished Struggle Inside the Timorese Resistance, which is published by South End Press. But in order for Matthew to continue his work investigating Indonesia and going in and out, this is the name we're calling him today. As I said, we're also joined by Sidawati from Jakarta,
Hi,
Indonesia.
Amy.
Hi, it's good to be with you. Again, this is also not her name because of the danger of speaking out against the Suharto regime. In your experience in Indonesia, is the activism that you're seeing now, the thousands of students who are protesting around Indonesia, is this a level of activism that hasn't been seen before?
Yeah, that's right. So for about, like, for the last 30 years, it's been very difficult for the students to get out of the campus. And actually, this is quite impressive that they could get gather peacefully 15,000 students in Jogja last time.
In Yogyakarta, one of the largest cities in Indonesia.
Right.
What has the experience been for you going through Indonesia, also visiting East Timor? What do you take from your trip?
Well, it is very interesting how the before I came here, I read mostly from the U.S. media, and it has so focused on what happened within the elite, with your government, and you don't really get a sense about what's going on in here. You know, what kind of economic crisis? How does the crisis affect the people at large? And how does the political, what is it, tension actually created some confusion among the activists? So going through, what is it, coming here and just going through from one meeting and another and see by myself what's going on really makes me understand better what's going on.
Despite the fact that the U.S.-supported dictator has been reappointed today, do you have a sense that this is the shakiest time for Suharto because of the activism around the country?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the crisis and also the protests since January really undermine a lot of the legitimacy, especially about the economic development. You know, I mean, Suharto came to power promising that the country would be prosperous, that he would bring the country into economic, prosperity. You know, that's the claim that the new order has been calling for, and now people are living hand to mouth, and that really shakes the regime legitimacy.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Sidawati, for joining us from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by U.S. student activists from around this country who are protesting their universities signing deals with Nike and Reebok, companies that are well known for making sneakers in Indonesia. Has that kind of activism in this country and the level of activity here, do you think, made a difference to people in the U.S. in terms of the visibility of the Suharto regime and what Suharto has wreaked on his people for the last 30, 35 years?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that really inspires people here, too, you know. I mean, there hasn't been so much information both in the U.S. and in Indonesia about what the U.S. are doing and what about what the Indonesian government is doing, you know.
Do the students in Indonesia get a good sense of what is happening here around the student activists?
Not really, actually. The press here is very tightly controlled. And so they got the news mainly from students who got access to the internet and or from those who come from the U.S. So I think it's very important for us to build like a special route beyond the mainstream press to exchange information so that the students here know better about what's going on in the U.S. Because like when Matthew came here and said that he is an activist, it's a lot of people are surprised, you know, that the U.S. has activists, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Sigawati, who is a pro-democracy campaigner in Indonesia, along with Matthew Jardine, traveling through Indonesia during these very pivotal days when people are protesting around the country and as the dictator is once again reaffirmed. They are speaking to us from Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, and I have to say it's amazing the quality of the phone lines internationally these days, which are better than making a call to someone down the street. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, a look at student activism in this country around corporations that go overseas to run sweatshops. Stay with us.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story, to keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. March Madness, the annual college basketball tournament, has begun. From the frenzied crowds of cheering students to the antics of head coaches and the spectacular athleticism of the players, the three-week-long tourney will be dominating much of the country's attention. But as the games go on, student activists will be stepping up their nationwide campaign against sweatshop products being worn by student athletes. And already there have been some big victories. Duke University this week announced a far-reaching code of conduct to ensure that products bearing its name are not made in sweatshops. We're now joined by a number of student activists. Benjamin Awe is a co-founder of Students Against Sweatshops at Duke University in North Carolina. We're also joined from the University of North Carolina in Durham by Quinn Moore of the Nike Awareness Campaign. And Dennis Gramenos is with us, a co-founder of the Student Labor Support Network at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. Let's begin with Benjamin Awe from Duke University. Can you tell us what this corporate code of conduct you have pushed for and actually succeeded in having the university adopt? Tell us what it is.
Well, basically, the code of conduct is this code that sets a standard of behavior for the corporations that market our products that have the Duke license mark on it, meaning that any corporation that wants to do business with us and produce our garments has to meet a certain standard of labor rights and provisions.
So what exactly does it say? I mean, does this mean that the university, Duke University, will be dropping some contracts?
Well, Duke University's administration has in the past and through our meetings blatantly said that they will, they flat out said that they will be willing to drop contracts if they are found to be in violation. Whether or not they are going to actually do that has yet to be seen. It's our sincere hope that they will. And through the process thus far, I believe that they will. They've been very cooperative, and actually our administration has been in full support of what we've been doing so far.
Dennis Gramenos of University, well, let me go to Quinn Moore of the Nike Awareness Campaign at the University of North Carolina. You've been, in your group, much more blatantly focusing on Nike, have been very critical of Nike, which is in contrast to the Duke University students. And so you've met with a lot of resistance from the university. You have a very important university in terms of sports, with Dean Smith being the coach of the former coach of the basketball team. Can you talk about that?
Well, we do have a different sort of tactic than Duke, and we have talked to the Duke students a lot, and you know, we're fighting for the same thing, but just with a different philosophy. And basically, we feel that since Nike is the industry leader, not just in terms of market share, but in terms of image, I mean, the swoosh is everywhere, and it's become a part of American culture. So we hope that by showing the labor conditions behind the swoosh, it would be a powerful way to raise awareness about what's going on with globalization in Southeast Asia. I mean, obviously, Nike is just is part of the problem, and it's not just Nike. But we hope that by pressuring Nike to change, the others will have to follow as well.
Can you explain what you understand about what Nike does overseas?
Basically, well, Nike has a code of conduct, actually, as well, but it's not enforced. There's not really any independent monitoring. Basically, there's a lot of forced overtime and poor labor conditions, low pay. Nike had commissioned the Ernst & Young to do a report on the conditions in their factory, and what was published in the United States originally was that everything is, you know, just fine, but the New York Times was leaked part of the report that wasn't published that basically showed that there were very bad conditions in the factory, mm-hmm. in terms of air quality and chemicals and that sort of thing.
Right, and that report was based on one of its factories in Vietnam, and it's interesting to note that, considering Ernst & Young did the report for Nike. They're paid by Nike. It's a report that they give to Nike. So even in that report, it was critical of Nike's practices.
Yes, exactly.
You also have, your perhaps the most famous alumnus of the University of North Carolina is Michael Jordan, who is a major spokesperson for Nike. Have you been in touch with him?
No, actually, we haven't. We've heard rumors that he is going to Southeast Asia this summer, but we don't really know anything about that. We haven't been able to talk to him. We did have a meeting with Dean Smith earlier this year, which went very well. We have information from very different sources, but he was very supportive of us as activists, and we still have a very good relationship with the athletics department. We've spoken with the athletics director several times, and still have a relationship.
In addition to Quinn Moore of the Nike Awareness Campaign at the University of North Carolina, we are joined by Dennis Gramenos, a co-founder of the Student Labor Support Network at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. Can you talk about some of the activity on your campus around Nike and around these large corporations that do business overseas with highly questionable practices?
Sure. Good morning. The Student Labor Support Network was founded earlier last semester as a labor rights organization here on campus. And right away, we focused on Nike Corporation because it is such a large company, and because of its blatant labor law and human rights violations overseas. Immediately, we brought the attention of the administration to these practices by Nike, and we raised awareness on campus and in the community, and we asked the administration of the University of Illinois to re-examine its affiliation with Nike. Now, mind you, the University of Illinois has an exclusive contract with Nike, whereby Nike provides several million dollars in cash to the university over a number of years, and hundreds of thousands of dollars in Nike products for the athletic teams of the University of Illinois. So it is quite a lucrative contract for the University of Illinois. No sooner had we raised this campaign than we were besieged by Nike PR flags here on campus, flown in and inundated by all sorts of public relations material distributed by them. So it has been a very difficult battle all along. However, recently the administration has announced that they are willing to examine the possibility of adopting a code of conduct, not unlike the one adopted by Duke University, and that they're willing to clarify their position vis-a-vis what the role of a public institution such as the University of Illinois should be vis-a-vis multinational corporations with questionable practices. That's where we are right now.
What is the feeling of the overall student population at the University of Illinois?
Well, for the most part, we find that students do not know about Nike's practices, or they're not very familiar with labor rights either. However, awareness has been raised, and it's constantly being raised on a daily basis, and more people come to understand how important it is that they should participate in this struggle. So it has been a very educational process and a very eye-opening process for a lot of these students.
I wanted to talk about how actually you've gone about organizing. Now, Benjamin Off from Students Against Sweatshops at Duke University in North Carolina, you have succeeded in getting a code of conduct agreed to by the administration. Now, one of the elements of that is that any corporation that the company that the university does business with would accept independent monitoring, but Nike has not agreed to independent monitors.
That's correct. Well, we've been through many drafts of this code of conduct, and basically, we started the basis of our code was the Notre Dame code from a few years ago, which at the time was heralded as a huge success. But the problem with that was, of course, independent monitoring. They didn't have any provisions for it. It called for self-policing. So our code has a clear provision for internal and external monitoring by both their monitor and NGOs. Through the process of drafting the codes, we've heard many objections from various companies, so far there have been moments when the university has backed down to comply with the company's wishes. However, they would not receive our approval, and since this is a student initiated effort, the university was very cognizant of the fact that they had to comply and get our approval of this final code. So we've gone ahead and passed this final draft that does call for internal and external monitoring.
Quinn Moore, I wanted to ask you of the Nike Awareness Campaign at the University of North Carolina if it's true that Nike has offered to pay for a trip of the Nike Awareness Campaign to Indonesia, as well as a student journalist on the newspaper. I know that has caused some questioning at the student newspaper whether they should accept a corporation paying for their trip. But can you tell us whether this is actually going to happen? Are you going to Indonesia? Are you going to Indonesia?
No. Well, I'm not personally, but the chancellor proposed, after the Nike representatives came to our campus, the chancellor proposed a student trip to Nike, to Nike factories in Southeast Asia, and Nike immediately agreed, but the Nike awareness campaign wasn't really consulted about the specifics of the trip beforehand, and we were concerned that the trip would turn into another sort of whitewash PR ploy where the participants wouldn't get to see anything real, and they wouldn't be able to have their own interpreters or all the problems that came about in the Ernst & Young and other reports commissioned by Nike. So we came up with a list of conditions for our support and involvement in the trip to ensure that it would be an academically rigorous process. And Nike agreed to our conditions, but we haven't really heard a lot from them since then. Apparently, they've had some meetings about the trip and trying to put it together, but we haven't really gotten any concrete information. And at this point in the semester, I'm so close to the summer, I'm pretty skeptical about whether that will actually happen. And like I said, it wasn't really our... we think it could be a very positive thing if it were done the right way and done objectively and allowed to be structured the way that in an academically rigorous way.
Quinn, I wanted to ask how it is that you organized. I mean, how do you start a group? I bet there are students who are listening now around the country and ask, where do they begin? I mean, there are Nike swooshes all over the campus. I also want to ask about this issue of the requiring of campus athletes at universities that sign contracts with, say, Nike or Reebok, that they have to wear the logo. I've heard of cases where students who put tape over the logo, you know, they're provided with the equipment or the clothes, but they don't like to be a walking or running billboard, get in trouble.
Yeah, you're not allowed to disparage the swoosh in any way. That's written into all of the contracts.
You're not allowed to. This is like Oprah disparaging beef. You're not allowed to disparage the swoosh.
Yeah, you can't cover it up in any way or put anything on your uniform that would disparage the swoosh, I think is the wording of the contract. And, you know, we have some serious problems with that. And I think that even becomes, you know, a free speech issue.
I understand that at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which was signing a contract with Reebok, they had in the contract a clause that said no one at the university could disparage the good name of Reebok, could speak in any way critically of Reebok. And this so incensed people in the Wisconsin state legislature that they had that clause taken out.
Yeah, that was actually, they tried to have that put into the Nike contract here as well, I think, but that they didn't let it happen. The university administrators didn't.
Dennis Grimeno, Sir Benjamin Awe, do you have stories like that on your campuses at the University of Illinois or at Duke University?
Actually, we have a clause in our athletic contracts that allows for any individual athlete to wear, if they have strong objections, to wear a different brand. We're not under the same kind of stringent regulations that it sounds like Chapel Hill.
This is Benjamin from Duke?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Dennis Grimenos?
Well, at the University of Illinois, we have similar clauses as at North Carolina that prohibit disparagement, basically, of the product. I do not believe anybody is really allowed to speak out against it as far as quality, et cetera.
Well, listen, I would like to get the phone numbers of your different groups as people, I think you're planting a lot of ideas in people's heads. Benjamin Awe, Duke University, North Carolina, can you give us the number of Students Against Sweatshops?
Sure. The area code is 919-956-6416.
That's 919-956-6416. Dennis Grimenos, Student Labor Support Network at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, area code is 217, and the number is 367-9144.
That's 217-367-9144. By the way, I also want to welcome listeners from WEFT in Champaign-Urbana because they've just started picking up Democracy Now! Quinn Moore of the Nike Awareness Campaign at the University of North Carolina, your phone number.
It's 919-967-1351.
That's 919-967-1351, and we will certainly follow all of your activities around the country. And Quinn, let us know if you end up going to Indonesia.
Okay.
We'll expect a report from Jakarta. Thank you very much, Benjamin Odd, Dennis Gramenos, and Quinn Moore, students around the country who are working around the issue of corporate responsibility. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be speaking with the sister of Roisin McCloskey, and she's going to tell us about this surprise announcement of the British government that has also come as a result of international activism. Stay with us.
Of a seabird as it opens its wings to the gale, and as it soars o'er the island, it follows.
That was The Seabird from the CD Some Mother's Son. And by the way, that is a movie that you should see. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. After an international campaign, the British government announced yesterday that Roisin McCloskey, the daughter of Irish civil rights leader Bernadette Devlin McCloskey, will not be extradited to Germany. She was to face charges related to an IRA mortar attack on a British army base there. 26-year-old Roisin was arrested in November of 1996 and gave birth to a daughter while in prison in London. Her supporters said the charges were trumped up by the British and German governments, and human rights groups worldwide denounced the inhumane treatment suffered by Roisin during her detention. One of the interesting aspects of this case is while Britain decided whether to extradite Roisin to Germany, if it was reversed and there was a German citizen in Germany requested by the British government to be extradited, Germany does not extradite its own citizens. We're joined right now by Deirdre McCloskey, who is in the United States. She was to begin a tour of this country to talk about her sister's case, to try to get her freed. And, well, it looks like that trip will be cut short.
I think so, Amy. I think it's going to be cut short.
Well, tell us what happened. In fact, you just spoke with Roisin, didn't you?
Yeah, I spoke with her this morning. I couldn't get her yesterday. She wisely turned her phone off, so I didn't get to speak with her. She's in good form, obviously. She's in great spirits. She's not making any immediate plans. In reality, for Roisin, she's not well enough to leave the hospital yet. So for the immediate weeks, it just doesn't have an immediate impact for her. But at least she can make plans from here on out.
Were you surprised by the British government's announcement?
Yeah, well, we heard the news yesterday at about 1 o'clock or 6 o'clock our time at home, and it was a surprise announcement for us yesterday. My mother, Gareth Pearce's office, Roisin's solicitor, received a short fax from the Home Secretary saying that to continue with the proceedings he deemed unjust or oppressive, and proceedings would be stopped. And as much as it was a surprise, the Irish government indicated to us last week that they were confident of a good decision within the next 10 days. But it's very hard as a family to base ourselves around a week and 10 days, because that's how it was in the very early days of Roisin's arrest. Everything, we worked from 1 week to the next, and it's very hard then as a family to go back to surviving and depending upon what the next week brings. So we didn't really prepare ourselves for this decision.
Can you tell us, Deirdre, for listeners who aren't as familiar with Roisin's case, I just gave a brief synopsis, mm-hmm. but what exactly happened in November of 1996?
Roisin was arrested at her own home in Killyland on her way to a hospital, her first hospital appointment for her pregnancy, her first checkup. Police raided her home which was previously our home, my mother's home, and a flat which Roisin had lived in Belfast simultaneously. And Roisin was arrested from her own home, not on charges relating to Germany. In fact, with emergency law in Northern Ireland, you're not arrested on a specific offence. And she so was arrested under the Emergency Provisions Act and was held in Castlereagh Detention Centre.
And what did they say? What were they? Why did they say they took her?
Well, they don't have to, and they didn't. They don't have to give you any reason, and they didn't. The questioning during Roisin's initial detention was very general, was based on she was asked about known Republicans in Belfast. She was asked about their whereabouts. She was asked what she knew of Republicans in Belfast, about people who are ex-prisoners, Roisin's partner is an ex-prisoner. And it was only in the late days of her detention at Castlereagh, the fifth or sixth day, that this notion of Germany was introduced. And very much Roisin felt at that time as a threat, because she had not complied with the officers in Castlereagh. She had not spoken to them, and she had refused at that point to become an informer or to sign a statement for activities in which she was not involved. And Germany very much, we believed at that time, was introduced as a threat and never was meant to be anymore. I mean, they said to Roisin right up until the final days when the officer from Scotland Yard came to Castlereagh to take her, they said this could still be torn up if you sign.
Now, what happened in Osnabrück, in Germany? What was this mortar attack on the base?
There was an attack, I think it was June 28th, on an army base in Osnabrück. It was an empty army. There was no one there. It was a failed attack. I don't think the mortars went off. One did, and no one was injured. It was an aborted attack.
Mm-hmm. And had Roisin been in Germany?
No. In fact, she's the only one of us who doesn't even have a passport.
And so what evidence did Germany present to the British government to show that they had grounds to have her extradited that indicated that she had been in Germany and participated in this mortar attack?
Very little, Amy. With the new European extradition treaty, you no longer have to present a prima facie case at the outset. So, in fact, the German authorities did not have to lay out their case until Roisin went to Germany. Defendant now has no right to hear that prima facie case in the country of arrest. You have to go to the country that seeks your extradition. What they did lay out in the warrant was scant. It was based largely around identification evidence, on the evidence of Herr Schmidt, who was a German who owned the holiday home in which the IRA bombers were supposed to have stayed. He supposedly positively identified Roisin to be a woman calling herself Beth. And the other piece of evidence they put forward was a fingerprint. And the nature of that evidence, as it was written in the warrant, changed a number of times, to being found on a piece of cellophane, to being at the site of the attack, to being at the house, to being in a rubbish bin. That was completely inconsistent.
Let's talk about the international activism around this case. I think a lot of times people who work on different issues feel discouraged, feel like they cannot make a difference. When Roisin McCallisky was taken by the British authorities, the response was enormous, perhaps because of the how well-known your mother is, Bernadette Devlin McCallisky, among other things. I mean, an Irish civil rights leader, also the youngest member of parliament ever. That's of the British parliament. Tell us what happened around the world.
Well, I mean, the international human rights community took this case on from the very beginning. And in that way, we were very fortunate, and like you say, very much based on my mother's reputation and the commitment that she had offered to other struggles around the world. And in that way, we were very fortunate as a family, because there were a number of Republican prisoners and young women specifically who were targeted at the same time, who were in at that time in the same position as Roisin, who didn't have the network or the support that we did have. Women's groups initially were the first, certainly in Belfast, to take the issue on board when, at that early stage, political parties steered clear. Eventually, those people came on board. It became a bit of a bandwagon, and whenever the road was clear and it was clearly set out as a human rights issue, a lot of people came on board, and thankfully they did. Certainly, committees here sprung up overnight. The New York committee has been singularly amazing in the work that they have done, and similarly in San Francisco, another committee. But clearly, without that international impact, that yesterday's decision would not have happened, or certainly would not have happened at this stage.
And explain what people did.
People worked in their various capacities within the women's groups, within the human rights organisations, doing what they could do. Some people have boycotted Bexbier, have done what they can do. That's what everybody can do, is not buy a German product, is not buy the single biggest export from Germany. There have been rallies, there has been an amazing information campaign, largely based here in New York and in Belfast, And that's probably been the most powerful aspect, because it's been a very well organised and a very together campaign, and I think that was very, very visible to the British authorities.
We're talking to Deirdre McCalliskey, and she is the sister of Rasheen McCalliskey and daughter of Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey. And we just got news yesterday that the British government has announced that they will not be extraditing Rasheen McCalliskey to Germany. What does this mean? She's in the hospital. When she gets better, she can just go home?
Well, for Rasheen, like I say, immediately, it doesn't mean an awful lot today, because she's not well enough to leave the hospital. I said I spoke to her this morning. She's in good spirits. She's in good form, and she's beginning to make plans. While it's a brilliant decision, it's an excellent decision, it's certainly not the end of the campaign, because we still demand that Germany withdraw the warrant for Rasheen's arrest. That still stands. Simply, the British government have stopped their extradition proceedings, but we want Rasheen to be free and to be safe wherever she is. There are a number of issues, firstly and primarily the warrant, which we demand to be withdrawn, but secondly, the nature of Rasheen's arrest and detention still must be investigated on the basis of the human rights issue, and that this could and will happen to someone else again.
When you say the British government still has not dropped its arrest warrant, its charges, what are they then?
The German authorities, the warrant for Rasheen's arrest, and in fact the nature of the warrant is for questioning in connection with, so there are not any related charges at this stage. There never have been any charges actually put to Rasheen, or she hasn't been charged with any specific offence. But the warrant for her arrest in questioning with the attack still stands. And so were Rasheen to be, even in the south of Ireland, that we don't have that guarantee that Rasheen would not be extradited from there, although we're pretty confident in as much as the Foreign Affairs Department of the Irish government have been central to Rasheen's release. The position still stands that if she goes to another country, she could be extradited from there. The warrant for her arrest still stands, and it's absolutely critical now that that's withdrawn completely.
I'm looking at a Reuters wire piece from London that says government spokespeople refuse to comment on whether the announcement was timed to affect the Northern Ireland peace talks. Can you talk about that, how this plays into that? It says the IRA-allied Sinn Féin party announced yesterday it would not attend the talks unless its leaders could meet with the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. They want reassurance that their demands, which have included McCalliskey's immediate release, would be addressed.
Yeah, well, obviously this hasn't happened in isolation. The decision that Jack Straw made yesterday, he could have made in January. He could have made any day up until now. He didn't.
He's the Home Secretary.
It suited the British government yesterday for reasons best known to themselves. But obviously, and Rasheen has been used as a pawn in this political process. She could have been brought out, depending upon the situation with Republicans in the talks, the situation with the talks process itself. It didn't suit the British government until now to release Rasheen. And yesterday it did. Yesterday it didn't seem to matter to us very much why they did. Today, in the clear light of day, of course, it's part of something else, and there'll be a balance somewhere along the line for what has happened.
Deirdre McCalliskey, while Rasheen was in jail, you became an aunt.
That's right.
How old is Rasheen's baby?
Linear will be 10 months old on the 26th.
Oh, that's
the
amazing.
End of this month.
Huh. Because she went in when she was pregnant.
Yeah.
Can you tell our listeners what that was like for her? I remember during her incarceration, before the baby was born, all the descriptions of what it would be like when she gave birth. Mm-hmm. What was feared and what actually happened?
Well, for Rasheen, an awful lot of the difficulty of this has been that she's a very private person. Her entire life and her entire future became someone else's life and future. And for Rasheen as a person, that's been very, very difficult. Most of the pressure exerted upon Rasheen, when we got to a point where the international human rights community were aware of the case and were involved, psychological pressure mainly was exerted upon Rasheen. She was constantly under threat of being manacled during the birth of her baby, of having her baby taken away. There were a number of incidents with individual staff within the prisons who threatened physical violence against Rasheen, and people saying things like "one punch in the right place and this baby's gone." So that kind of threat was there all the time. And none of this has been won lightly. Not yesterday's decision and not any decision we got to now. Everything has been a high court battle to have Rasheen keep her baby, to have Rasheen released to a hospital. None of this has been won easy. And for Rasheen, it's more a beginning of the end. It's light at the end of the tunnel.
I know that your mother, Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey, who said, of course, she was delighted and relieved, and now the family can concentrate on getting Rasheen well again, believes that Rasheen was singled out because of the whole family's anti-British background and because of the activism also of her partner, the baby's father, Sean McCotter, as you were saying, who's a former IRA prisoner. What will this mean for your activism, both in this country and at home and your families?
Well, as you say, Mia, I arrived to do a tour of the States. That was a bit of a one-stop tour. I did the rally on International Women's Day. And because we had indications that there would be a decision, I asked people to refocus and to put the commitment and strength that they had that put into this case into other cases. Specifically, the lesson that we have learnt has been that prison is a singularly inhumane experience and certainly is not designed for human beings, but very specifically is not designed for women or for women with children. And certainly in terms of immediate activism and people's energies and certainly our energies, prisoners' issues are going to be the top of that agenda.
When do you go back home?
Good question. I don't know. Some things are cancelled. Some celebrations are planned. I don't know yet.
Well, Deirdre McCalliskey, if people want to continue to be involved in this case, as you say, Rasheen is not out yet, and there are many people who are still in prison. Mm-hmm. Is there a number that you can give people? I know we didn't talk about this before, so maybe you don't have one off the top of your head.
I don't have it, but certainly WBAI, and this is probably a good time to thank them for everything that they have put into Rasheen's case, have a number for the Friends of Rasheen McCalliskey who continue to be involved and will be involved until the warrant is dropped against Rasheen. So...
Well, you have a friend right here.
Yeah, he's looking
instead
for the
of
number.
Her writing down the number, I'll just ask her to say the number right now.
718-436-4770.
One more time.
718-436-4770. And we meet at Rocky Sullivan's Bar on 29th and Lexington, Friday night, 7 p.m.
Well, that's in New York. So if people are in California or in Hawaii or Washington State, I guess buy a plane ticket. Well, I want to thank you very much, Deirdre McCalliskey, the sister of Bernadette McCalliskey, the sister of Rasheen McCalliskey, daughter of Bernadette Devlin McCalliskey, on this day after the British government has announced they will not return Rasheen McCalliskey back to, they will not return her to Germany. She is now in a hospital, and we will continue to monitor her movements and let people know when she is freed. Today we're going to go out with more music from Some Mother's Son, which is a movie, I think you can get it on video now, about IRA prisoners in the early 1980s. Again, thank you very much, Deirdre McCalliskey.
Thank you, Amy.
Even though we just sort of signed off, I have to ask you, Deirdre, were you in this movie, Your Mother's Son?
Yes, I was.
Who were you?
you're not going to believe this. An activist for political prisoners.
Some surprise, really?
Yeah.
This is for Bobby Sand and for the others
from the
early 1980s.
That's right.
Well, talents we didn't even know you had. Folks, if you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland engineered today's show. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Whichever